Welcome to Hanchuck Targets History. I'm your host, Tim Hanchuck. Thanks for joining me this episode. You know, I've been teaching high school history for way too many years, and I love talking about this stuff. So let me share with you some interesting, unique, and little-known historical events. I know you'll be entertained, and if you're not careful, you just might learn something too. So, let's lock and load and take a shot at that target of history and see what we can hit. Hey, it looks like we hit on a little bit of sporting history. Yes, today we'll be talking about the 1904 Olympic Marathon, which is no doubt the most bizarre marathon ever to be contested in the Olympic Games. When a runner hitching a ride in a car is far from the strangest thing to happen, you know things are going to get crazy. Let's start with the 1904 Olympic Games, which were held in St. Louis. The games themselves were more than unusual. This was the first time the Olympics were being held outside of Europe, since the first games in 1896 were in Athens, and the 1900 games were in Paris. The thing is, though, that it was the city of Chicago who was awarded the games for 1904, but scheduled for that same time in late summer was the St. Louis World's Fair, which was also called the Louisiana Purchase Exposition. The St. Louis organizers got all grumpy, saying that they would not tolerate another international event in the same time frame. They went on to say that if the games were not moved to St. Louis, then they'd stage their own international sporting contest that would surely eclipse the Olympics. At this point, Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the modern Olympics, stepped in and said the games would be moved to St. Louis. Ah, the rewards of whining like a spoiled brat. Too bad for you, Chicago. So the games would be held in St. Louis, with the World's Fair going on at the same time. Huge crowds in a decidedly over-the-top circus-like atmosphere. Of course, most of the spectators were from the United States. Remember, in 1904, the Russo-Japanese War was going on, and this caused some international tensions. Couple this with the difficulties of travel to the middle of the United States, and many foreign athletes decided to stay home. Only 12 nations would send athletes to the games, although some sources claim it was 15. A total of 651 athletes would compete, but all except for 66 of them would come from North America, with Canada sending 56, Cuba sending 3, and the other 526 being from the United States. As part of the fair, its organizers staged a two-day exhibit called Anthropology Days. Events like this had been all the rage since the Paris Exposition of 1889. The idea was that various indigenous peoples from the Americas, Africa, and Asia would be on display to showcase their culture as part of a demonstration of anthropological notions of race, progress, and civilization. Let's be blunt here. This whole thing was a human zoo, and obviously extremely racist. It was even decried in its day by some people, including de Coubertin, who called it an outrageous charade. He no doubt was kicking himself for moving the games out of Chicago. So, in this carnival-like atmosphere, we have the running of the marathon, the signature event of the Olympics, conceived to honor the classical heritage of Greece and highlight the connection between ancient and modern. And on paper, the 1904 Olympic marathon seemed to have the potential for a great race. Even though there was only one runner who had participated in the 1900 Olympic marathon, Arthur Newton of the U.S., there were some other big-name distance runners, including the winners of the last three Boston marathons. That would be Sammy Meller in 1902, John Lorden in 1903, and Michael Spring earlier that year. Thomas Hicks also had a number of marathons under his belt, including a second-place finish at Boston in 1903. Other U.S. contestants were more middle-distance runners, including Fred Lors, who had to train at night because he was a bricklayer by day. he qualified by winning a 5-mile race sponsored by the AAU. There was also Frank Pierce of the Seneca Nation, who became the first Native American to compete for the United States in the Olympics. Not much marathon experience from the middle distance guys, but they were fierce competitors. There were 10 Greek athletes, none of whom ever ran a marathon. 9 of them would actually participate in the race. There was a mailman from Cuba, Felix Carbajal, who raised money to travel to St. Louis by staging a charity run the entire length of Cuba. On a side note, upon arriving in New Orleans on his way to the games, he lost all his money in a dice game and had to walk and hitchhike the rest of the way to St. Louis. Even so, he was seen as a favorite. There were also 2 Tswana tribesmen from South Africa named Len Tau and Jan Mashiani, who happened to be there for the South African exhibit. Both had been long-distance message runners during the Boer War, and Tau especially was seen as another favorite. These guys were the first 2 black athletes to represent South Africa in the Olympics. As a matter of fact, they were the only 2 until the end of apartheid 86 years later. Some people claim that both of these guys ran the race barefoot, but in reality, Mashiani wore shoes. There's even a photograph showing shoes on his feet at the start of the race. And speaking of running a marathon barefoot, let's remember the great Abibi Bakila of Ethiopia, who took the 1960 gold in Rome running barefoot. He won gold again in 64 in Tokyo, but he wore shoes for that one. But I digress. Let's get back to the story. The plan for the 1904 Olympic marathon was for it to start in the Olympic Stadium built specifically for these games. It was on the campus of Washington University and is known as Francis Field. Washington U's football team currently plays there. It's since been renovated, although an original gate from the Olympics still exists to this day. Anyway, the runners would run 5 laps around the stadium track. The track was 1/3 mile cinder oval. This was before running tracks had a standardized distance. After the 5 laps, they'd exit the stadium and take various roads throughout the area before returning to the stadium for the finish. The overall course was 24.85 miles. Yes, that was before the marathon distance was standardized at 26.2 miles. So on Tuesday, August 30th, 32 Olympians lined up for the start of the race. There were actually 40 men entered, but 8 were no-shows. Most wore the standard racing gear of that era, shorts and a tank top kind of shirt, although we've already mentioned that Tau was barefoot. Cuban mailman Carbajal showed up for the race wearing the only clothes he had after his gambling loss. A long-sleeved dress shirt, dark pants, dress shoes, and a rather jaunty beret. A fellow competitor scrounged some scissors so he could make the pants into a pair of cut-off shorts, though he'd still have to compete in dress shoes. At a few minutes after 3 in the afternoon, former Missouri governor and stadium namesake David R. Francis fired the starting pistol and the race began. And the starting time itself should be the first indicator that this would not be a normal race. Usually, marathons are run in the early morning to try to take advantage of the cooler part of the day. This was 3 p.m. in late August in the American Midwest. The temperature at the start of the race was 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That would be 32 degrees Celsius, with very high humidity. And it wouldn't drop below that for most of the race. For the first 5 laps around the track, various men jockeyed for position and the lead changed a number of times. On the 3rd lap, John Lorden, who, as I said, had won the 1903 Boston Marathon, suddenly began vomiting and wandered off the track. He would be the first of many to drop out of the race. After the 5 laps, the runners left the stadium and began the rest of the course. Most of it was along country roads. The course was actually laid out by a guy named James Sullivan, who was also the head of the Physical Culture Department for the World's Fair. He was the guy behind the outrageously racist anthropological days I already mentioned. Apart from being a big-time racist, Sullivan also fancied himself somewhat of an expert on exercise science, and he designed a marathon course to test one of his firmly held beliefs, that of purposeful dehydration. See, Sullivan argued that drinking during strenuous exercise would upset the stomach and hinder performance. As a result, the marathon course was designed to offer very little water to the runners. Some sources state there were two places for athletes to get a drink, at the 6 and 12 mile marks. Other sources mention water only being available at the 12 mile mark. So to recap thus far, running a marathon in 90 degree heat with high humidity and circumstances designed to purposefully dehydrate the competitors. Is there any one of you kind listeners who thinks this has an even remote chance of ending well? But wait, there's more. As I said, most of the course was over country roads, dirt roads that were dry in the summer heat. Traveling in front of the runners and also following them were the race officials riding in cars. Cars carrying coaches, journalists, and medical staff actually drove alongside some of the runners. All these vehicles kicked up a continual dust cloud that exacerbated the already horrendous conditions. Many of the runners broke into periodic fits of coughing as they ran. With conditions like these, what zany antics transpired? Let's start with our Cuban mailman, Felix Carbajal. Despite his cut-off shorts and dress shoes, he was actually making good time. The problem, though, was that he was a rather outgoing and cheerful man. There were a number of times that he actually stopped running to briefly chat with spectators so he could practice his broken English. Also remember, being without funds meant that he hadn't eaten much in the previous days. As a result, he saw the occupants of a stopped car eating peaches. He asked if they'd give him one. When they refused, he playfully grabbed two and ran off, consuming the peaches on the run. The peaches were nice, but they didn't satisfy his hunger. So a few miles farther along, he saw an apple orchard. He stopped and quickly ate some apples. Unfortunately, the apples were a little bit rotten, and old Felix began to suffer from some pretty severe stomach cramps. To try to ease the pain, he decided to lay down under a tree and take a nap. When he awoke a little later, he felt somewhat better and resumed the race. By the way, he would end up finishing just off the podium in fourth place. Wow! Len Tau, the barefoot South African, was also running well, until he ran into a pack of wild dogs. The dogs went after him, and he was forced to break into a sprint to try to escape from them. They chased him for over a mile before he finally managed to shake him off. Fleeing from the dogs had tired him, and he had to retrace his steps over a mile to get back on the course. Despite this unexpected detour, Tau still managed a ninth place finish. Again, wow! Now at about the 10-mile mark, Fred Lors, the bricklayer, became plagued by severe muscle cramps. They got so bad that he flagged down a car, which many say was being driven by his coach, for a ride back to Francis Field. It's said he waved at spectators and fellow competitors as he drove past. We'll say more about Lors in a bit. Meanwhile, by the halfway point, Sammy Miller had the lead. Remember, he was one of the pre-race favorites. But by the 16-mile mark, dehydration caused cramping to begin, and he slowed his pace. To make matters worse, he incorrectly believed that he'd taken a wrong turn and began to run back the way he had come. Between the cramps and tiring himself out from running the wrong way, he soon dropped out of the race. With Miller out of the race, Thomas Hicks took the lead. This was well past the last water station, and he began to grow increasingly thirsty. he began to beg his trainers, who were following along in a car, for a drink of water. They refused, but did squeeze out a sponge over his head and shoulders and let him put the damp sponge in his mouth. Now, while Hicks led, but struggled, fellow American William Garcia of California was in fourth place. At about the 19-mile point, he began coughing up blood and collapsed at the side of the road. Fortunately for him, he was found and rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery. The heat and dehydration, combined with the constant dust clouds, caused his esophagus to become lined with dust and created a tear in his stomach lining. Doctors say that had he not been found when he was, he might have bled to death. Okay, back to Hicks in the lead. The sponge did nothing to slake his thirst, and his pace was beginning to slow. With about 7 miles left to go, his trainers decided to try a bit more than a damp sponge. They had Hicks drink a concoction of egg whites mixed with a small dose of strychnine. Yes, I know, strychnine is the main ingredient in rat poison, and is quite deadly. But it seems that in small doses, it can act as a stimulant. So yes, this is the first recorded instance of a performance-enhancing drug being used in the Olympics. Back then, though, there was no rule against it. That being said, it is currently banned from use in competition by the World Anti-Doping Agency. Yeah, you know, even if it wasn't, it's still rat poison. Now, while Hicks was getting a boost from his poison cocktail, Lors, who, if you'll recall, had been riding in a car, was feeling much better from his cramps. He decided to get out of the car and finish running the race, even though he had been driven for somewhere around 11 miles. One of Hicks's trainers saw him doing this and yelled for him to leave the course, but he just ignored this and continued to run. Lors ran back into the stadium to finish the race first in a time of just under 3 hours. While the crowd cheered for Lors, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, the 20-year-old daughter of then-President Teddy Roosevelt, was there to bestow the awards. She placed a laurel wreath on Lors' head and was about to present him with the gold medal when shouting in the crowd halted the proceedings. Witnesses called out that Lors had cheated by riding in a car. The embarrassed Lors immediately tried to weasel his way out of things by saying that, oh, it was all a big joke and that he wouldn't have really accepted the medal. Yeah, right. He was, of course, disqualified. As news of Lors getting DQ'd made its way back through the course to Hicks, he perked up and tried to quicken his pace. But even so, by this point, witnesses described him as having listless eyes, ashen skin, and a deteriorating gait. With about 2 miles to go, he came to a hill that almost defeated him. He slowed down into a walk, causing his trainers to give him another dose of strychnine and egg whites, along with a swig of brandy to wash it down. He was able to jog down the hill toward the stadium. During the last mile, Hicks began to hallucinate, thinking he still had the entire race left to run. He also begged his trainers for something to eat, and then told them he wanted to lie down for a nap. They gave him a bit more brandy, and he managed to reel into the stadium, with shambling steps, barely able to keep on his feet. His trainers basically supported him on both sides, lifting his body up while his legs moved back and forth. It was in this fashion that he crossed the finish line to win the race, with a time of 3 hours and 28 minutes. He immediately collapsed, and doctors had to work on him for an hour right there on the ground before he was well enough to even leave the stadium. Silver medalist Albert Corey came in 6 minutes later with a time of 3 hours 34 minutes, and Arthur Newton took bronze 13 minutes after that. Our buddy Carbajal, the Cuban mailman, took fourth, as I already mentioned. Other finishers continued to trickle in over the next few hours, but ready for this? of the 32 men who started the race, only 14 actually finished. This is by far the worst ratio of entrants to finishers in Olympic marathon history. And Hicks's winning time is the slowest ever for an Olympic marathon, by almost half an hour. Wow, what a race. Given the wackiness of this whole thing, it seems only fitting that I leave you with some odd post-race anecdotes. Winner Thomas Hicks was quoted after the race saying, "Never in my life have I run such a tough course." And you know what? Never in his life would he ever again run a marathon. As for cheater Fred Lohrs, well, he was given a lifetime ban from racing, although the ban lasted less than a year. And he went on to win the 1905 Boston Marathon. And yes, he actually ran the whole way. As for Carbajal, he continued competing. He came back to St. Louis the next year in 1905 to run in the inaugural All-Western Marathon and took a respectable third place. In 1906, the Cuban government, who hailed him as a national athletic hero, sent him to Athens to run a marathon during the intercalated games. Tragically, he disappeared en route, last being seen in Italy. Carbajal was presumed dead. The people of Cuba mourned him, and the press even ran obituaries. Don't be sad, though. Several months later, he popped up in Havana, alive and well, and resumed his racing career. Where had he been? I don't know. He wouldn't say. Finally, the fiasco of the 1904 marathon led members of the press, sporting officials, and even some Olympic committee members to call for its removal from future games. Fortunately, this didn't happen, and it's been contested at every Summer Olympics since. But talking about those races, well, that would be another story. And there you have it, kind listeners. Thank you for tuning in. You know, if you like this episode, please tell your friends and check out some of my other episodes. And I very much look forward to talking with you again next week.